Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Giuseppe Castellano, Executive Art Director at Penguin Random House, and here to answer your questions. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 339 of the podcast with Giuseppe Castellano. In addition to heading up art direction at Penguin Random House, Giuseppe also founded the Illustration Department, an online resource providing personalized guidance for illustrators of all experience levels. Every illustrator I know that knows Giuseppe has endlessly kind words about the generosity and insight and support he's shared to guide their careers in illustration. I think that kindness shines through in this collection of Q's and A's. The questions were provided by podcast listeners via Twitter and Facebook, so I hope that a few of you hear your questions asked on air. And for others, I think you'll find these questions universal and super helpful when paired with Giuseppe's responses. Here's episode number 339 of the podcast with Giuseppe Castellano. Welcome to the podcast, Giuseppe Castellano. I have waited to talk to you. I'm glad you're here.
I'm also glad I'm here. Thank you, Matthew, for inviting me.
Thank you, especially for your kindness to me, Giuseppe, for talking to me before talking on record. I admire you for what you do and for the person that you are to so many people. And I mean that. There's a lot of people who love you and respect you for the hard work you do and the way you lift other people up. And I'm grateful that you're one of those faces in children's publishing doing that good work.
Well, what can I say? That's I haven't had someone talk to me like that since I talked to my mother on the phone a few days ago.
nice.
being an Italian son and the youngest, you know, when you talk to your mother, you feel all sorts of goodness. But on all seriousness, I want to just thank you for inviting me onto this thing. I've joked several times that I kind of still don't really think I've deserved this invitation. I can think of a dozen or so art directors who would probably share stronger, bigger stories about Caldecott winnings and all of that sort of stuff. But I appreciate it. This is a privilege. What you and your team do. And now I'm going to gush in your direction. What you and your team do to embrace and promote the folks who create children's books is nothing short of inspirational and more importantly informational. And so on a personal level, I can't recommend the podcast enough. And again, thank you.
Well, on behalf of all of us working at All the Wonders, that's extremely flattering to hear that someone working at Penguin Random House, no less, values the work that we're doing that way. It's like with this podcast, you set out to create something beautiful and to celebrate the things you love, and you don't quite know who's going to connect directly with what you're doing or what your mission is, but you know that the people that do are going to be the ones that matter the most to you. And so I'm glad we're on the same frequency, man. That's great. And wait, I can tell you how I got connected with you, because you're around the internet, and these are the things that started drawing me closer and closer to you. So here, for people listening, are a bunch of different places they can track you down. I know you from Kidlit Art, from that wonderful Twitter chat that happens Thursday nights. And through that, I'm in a critique group with a group of illustrators. I'm sort of their token writer in the group. But they as well have had different relationships with you in having opportunities to Skype with you or to take classes with you through the illustration department or things like that, and learn more from you that way. And they talk so highly of you. All of them do, but specifically the people that are in the critique group with me. And also, you were on Shauna's podcast talking about agents and what to look for. And you've been on your own blog talking about sort of that, entering into publishing and how there's no right path, but here's sort of right signs to look for on the path. So there's things like that that have just connected me with you before we, in this so much way that it's in person, have been connected. So I've felt a kinship to you for a while now.
Well, thank you for all of that. That when you put it that way, it actually sounds like I know what I'm doing. But I assure you, I do not.
As much as any of us knows what we're doing, you're doing quite a fine job, my man.
Exactly. I really don't think anyone. I don't particularly think that anyone really truly knows what they're doing. We all have our. We all have our educated guesses, and we all believe that what we know is true and right. And we can only hope that the results bear witness to that.
Yeah. And also, behind closed doors, we're all freaking out a little bit about what we're doing.
Of course we are. Of course we are.
All right. So by day, Giuseppe, you are the executive art director at Penguin Random House. I know you told me before recording that you've been there for 18 years. How's life treating you at that job?
Pretty good. It's great. I've been there. I've been in publishing total for 18 years.
Oh, okay.
Cool. That was my mistake, probably. I've been at Penguin. Being at Penguin now for 5.5 years.
Oh, okay.
Or so. Before that, I was at Simon & Schuster for 12 years or so. And before that, I was in undergrad at RISD. Before that, I was at Calvert Hall High School in Towson, Maryland, which is not too far from Ellicott City, huh?
That's right. Towson is where I got my elementary education degree. I love the school. I've been around Maryland for a while.
Yes.
To hear the way you came into publishing through RISD with so many people. So many great people go through, well, Micah as well, but I know of many great people that go through RISD. Were your first steps in publishing and Simon & Schuster in that art directing role, or did you transition into that?
No.
No, I didn't figure.
Oh, God, no. No.
But you didn't work up from the mailroom. You aren't that kind of story, did you?
No, this isn't Elf, the movie, which is, by the way.
And I love you. I love you. I love you.
That movie, if anyone ever wanted to know, okay, what is publishing like? The very last movie to watch is Elf. That movie has nothing to do with publishing. It is unbelievable. I mean, it's a great movie. I love it. I have kids. We watch it all the time. But man, it is really wrong. No. I hope I don't sound repetitive, because I know that some people have possibly heard this if they hear me at conferences, or I'm sure my students have definitely heard this. I went to RISD, and when I went to RISD, I went to RISD for architecture originally, and did not think that was my jam. I just didn't think it was going to be. I don't know. Maybe I didn't have enough trust in myself to even think that I could have. I have the sort of mathematical and artistic chops to be an architect. So I quickly sort of transitioned to illustration. I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but that's what ended up happening. Senior year, I felt I needed to get a full-time job, for all the reasons that people feel like they need to get full-time jobs, not least of which is, you know, paying the rent and the insurance and all that. I interviewed with Simon & Schuster as a design assistant. And at the time, I really, truly did not know anything about children's books. I want to take it just a half a step back and say, I come very late to the children's book scene in terms of, I do. I mean, I've been doing this now for 18 years, but I still feel like I am incredibly behind on knowing who I need to know and, I don't know, just understanding the classics. I'm still kind of catching up on all of that. I grew up, again, in Maryland. You know, you and I are just a bunch of, two Maryland boys. I almost want this conversation to be had at a picnic table in late August, on a warm summer's day, laden with, well, first of all, covered in newspaper, because we're adults, but laden with just like a hot bushel of Maryland blue crabs with a little Old Bay seasoning and a pitcher of beer, and then we are off to the races. Man, just two Delmarva boys talking about children's books.
There it is.
But just getting back on the rails here, I grew up not reading books at all, just not even close. I wasn't a reluctant reader. I just wasn't a reader. My parents are Italian immigrants, and they both had, fifth grade education levels in southern rural Italy. They came over here in the 60s. My dad came over here on a ship he was in steerage for 10 days. He came over here on a ship. I mean, you think this is like the 1920s, but it was 1966. On a ship in steerage for 10 days, he made it to New York, saw the Statue of Liberty. You know, that whole story. I mean, that happened. That was my father.
Wow.
Fifth grade education, rural Italy. So that's what I was raised by I was raised by these Italian immigrant parents who just education. They knew that I needed to go to school and get good grades. They knew that, but that's the extent. You know, I'm not upset by it or anything, but they didn't introduce children's books to us. It just wasn't a thing. I remember having an Encyclopedia Brown or two in my room. I remember having a few choose your own adventures, but I just never read. I read, this is when I became a design assistant at Simon & Schuster in 1999. That was my first sort of acquaintance with the possibilities of the genre of mm-hmm. children's books.
We sound similar. It was really when I was in undergrad, when I was working at a before and after school care and doing a minor in education, where I was like, oh, books, I should read these. I kind of haven't.
Oh, yeah.
My parents I didn't read middle grade and beyond. As soon as I could read independently, that was sort of it.
Right. Exactly. I mean, my first, and I don't know, maybe this isn't true. I say it for effect, but I say that my first book that I physically turned the back cover over when I finished the book was Fahrenheit 451, and that was in 2000, 1 year after I graduated from college. Hmm. That maybe that was the first book I completed for fun, for pleasure, even though for pleasure, for Fahrenheit 451, that's a lot of fun. but that was really the first book that I read because I wanted to read it, and not because I was asked to. But when I was a kid, I mean, I was born in 77, the year Star Wars came out, and I'm a Star Wars kid. I'm a kid that loved watching Saturday morning cartoons, mm-hmm. Smurfs, Thundar, Thundercats, Silverhawks, Transformers, GoBots. I mean, that was me. And I'm sure there were, a lot of kids, a lot of people can say that, but that's what I was interested in, drawing and cartoons.
Yeah.
And then 1985 came around, and then I became interested in video games. And of course, with the sort of the onset with the Nintendo, you had your Hogan's Alley and your Kung Fu Alley and your Mario Brothers 1 and Zelda, of course. And so I read those books. I read booklets from the boxes of those videos.
Or Nintendo? Did you have Nintendo Power?
Nintendo Power.
That's right.
Yeah. I read Nintendo Power. I mean, that's what I read.
Just because I'm nerdy this way, that we are talking on the day that the Nintendo Switch came out, which I did not get a pre-order on, but I do have Breath of the Wild. on Wii U. So I'm excited that, that this none of this matters to anybody. Although there are plenty of Illustrator gaming nerds out there that I know are like getting the tingles with us talking about this.
But that's, I mean, that's, here's the point. I don't want to ramble on, but the point is I didn't read children's books, but I did read those books. I read the backs of G.I. Joe packaging. You know, that was interesting to me, and it was illustrative. There was some text to it, even though it was all marketing, but it was interesting to me as a kid. And I, that's what I read. I read Nintendo Power. So I come very late to books. It's, I think it's very safe to say now that I am definitely a convert. I think, you know, and the thing about converts is that they tend to be a little bit more fanatic than people who are brought up in any religion. So that is me. I am definitely a convert to children's books, and I'm still catching up.
Well, I don't think I realized how similar of a path we walked. I love it. But to go from really falling hard into children's literature that way to all the work you do, I can see where that fanaticism is fueling a lot of what you do. Why don't we talk a little bit about the illustration department? Do you want to share, for those that are unfamiliar with it, what you're doing over there?
Sure. So the illustration department is let me just take one half step back for a second. Illustration is a very difficult and very challenging endeavor. I think that's not anything new. It's not a novel idea. It's hard. It's incredibly hard. And it's a solitary occupation. It is challenging on many levels, both emotionally, even physically. I mean, I've talked to illustrators. I've seen illustrators post on social media how they have carpal tunnel and they have back issues. I mean, it beats you up, man. It really does on many levels. And when I started having kids, my oldest is 9, but when I started having kids and I really started having these sort of long form conversations with the illustrators about how challenging this occupation can be and how these people are relying on illustration to raise a family, I felt that there had to be a way to at least, at the very least, point out the potholes on the highway, you know, and not just say like, okay, well, here's the formula. If you do this formula, you'll be, you know, prosperous and whatever that way that means. But not that. Just,
I knew there was a formula. I was waiting for you to say it.
Yeah. No, we'll get there. If you continue to listen to this podcast, at the very end, we'll talk about the formula. But there's it's a tough road to hoe. It really is. And so the illustration department's mission is to help illustrators move forward in whatever way that means. If it means helping you get out of your own head, because believe me, I am with you on that. I am in my own head sometimes as an illustrator many times where I just start thinking of the thousands of illustrators, not thousands, but you know, dozens of illustrators who do it better than I do, who come to the solution quicker than I do visually, who have better technique than I do, who are more successful than I am, who post on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and wherever, all of these beautiful illustrations that are not even, you know, stratospherically ahead of the game related, you know, compared to my work. And that, so you get into your own head. And so the illustration department helps you kind of get out of that a little bit. And it also helps with, you know, I don't know what brush to use, you know, traditional brush or even digital brush. And what does that mean? You know, whatever hurdles keep you as an illustrator from moving forward, the illustration department's main goal is to at the very least help you sort of traverse that hurdle and sort of get you at least a few steps further down the road.
That's nice. I have browsed the different services or tools that you offer with critiques and with classes and just it does feel like you've left options open enough for people to ask themselves, what do I need? What do I think I need?
Yeah.
Or even maybe even you know, I'm a writer. I'm aware of this process too, of feeling like, what am I ready for now? Not necessarily what do I need, but what can I take on now? What level of investment can I give to myself for now, to move forward?
What's really interesting about that is I've learned, I've been doing this now for a few years, you know, the illustration department being this, you know, sort of online school of sorts for illustrators. And I've been doing this for a few years, and it's helped me be a better teacher and a better art director, because I'm forced to concisely critique their work and speak truths in ways that doesn't hurt egos. And that's really, I'm not saying I'm good at it, but it's helping me get better. It's not easy to do. Illustration is an art form. It is your art. And when you have someone say to you, your art doesn't look very good, they're basically saying to you, your baby is not cute.
Yeah.
And that is apparent. And, you know, as a parent, you don't want people saying that your kids are cute. So that's what the illustration department does. It's a series of classes. There's a portfolio review if you want that. There's a 3-week, and all of it is very personal. It is via, you know, Google Hangout or whatever, you know, it's online chat. We see each other. We see each other's faces. We talk about what we both think about your work, and we get to the bottom of it. You know what I mean? We try to figure out what you need to do as an illustrator to move forward. And for the price of going way back, pre-internet, the way it used to be is that you would visit, literally pound the pavement. I don't even know if illustrators these days, illustration students today, know what pounding the pavement means, because it's just not a thing that happens anymore. You know, when you literally walk on sidewalks and knock on doors and do all of the things that you have to do as an illustrator to get yourself out there. You know, we'll talk a little bit more about marketing later, but that's what you do. And now, I like to believe this is in my own mind, I guess, that the illustration department for the low price of taxes that you pay for your airline ticket to get to New York City, you can take a 3-week picture book dummy class with us.
Yeah. So let me ask you, knowing that you write children's books yourselves, mm-hmm. How has that been for you? Maybe even just when did you decide that this is something you wanted to pursue, creating your own stories? And how has the process of being an art director, working so closely with illustration, much like me working with children's books every day, how has that informed, your growth, your pursuit, maybe mm-hmm. how hard you are on yourself? I feel like I edit harder than many people might believe because of how avidly I read and how much I'm aware of what else is out there.
Exactly. You called it right there. You're just so aware of how well everyone else writes and how good everyone else is that you question your own you question your own abilities, and that is goodness. That is really the crux of being the challenge of being an illustrator. And I imagine the same would be for being a writer. We're risk averse. You know, we want to avoid risk. We want to avoid failure. We want to know that whatever steps we are taking will result in something positive. And sometimes that's not the case. And a lot of times we can't face that. We can't face the fact that what is in our heads, that perfect thing that's in our heads, whether it's a chapter or a book or an illustration or whatever, isn't going to come out the way it's going to come out on a blank piece of paper. So to answer your question really quickly, you know, as an art director, it's my own illustration style is very work in progress. I'm not totally in love with it, but again, I don't know. I haven't had any conversations with any illustrator, both professionally and on an amateur level, who is happy with their work. Hmm. You know, have you ever, you've interviewed a slew of illustrators. Have you ever heard anyone say, oh, I'm so excited about my own work. I'm so excited with my style. I'm happy with who I am.
I feel like even weekly as I talk to my critique group, I can hear phrases like, I'm really proud of this, but then there's often that padding of, but I feel like this could still be better, but I feel like I could still tweak this.
Because
we've talked about the idea of where to stop editing yourself and say, it's time to send this out the door.
Right.
That it's hard when to walk away from it. It's very hard.
Yeah, it's really incredibly hard. But to go back to the writing, to get back to your question on the writing. So yes, I am writing children's books, and I have two. I have two fully fleshed out manuscripts in with my agent Alexandra Penfold. And the funny thing about writing is that now that I do not consider myself to be, I don't purport to be an expert in writing at all. I am far from that. But the one thing I have come to realize about writing is that, at least for me, writing and drawing come from the exact same place. This is a realization that I'm currently having. One word, is particularly with picture books where, there are 200 words or whatever, one word or one gesture with one flick of the wrist as an illustrator can change the entire story. Writing and drawing both are sort of these acts of discovery that, that you have to go through. I mean, you have to get to that point where you are writing and you are drawing and you are discovering. And this discovery can be in the form of you are discovering the thing that you are drawing. So it can be that literal, or you are discovering something about yourself, and it can be that personal. For me, when I'm drawing, it's mostly personal. It's mostly, wow, I really am not really that good or as good as I think I am at drawing. So I keep drawing and I keep challenging myself, and it's not perfect and it's not great and I don't think it ever will be, and that's okay. But that's the thing I'm realizing about writing. And what, as I approach writing, and I went to art school. I did not go to, I'm not an English lit major. I didn't read until I was, 55 years old. So it's still a real work in progress and a real challenge for me. But as I approach writing, this works for me, at least for now. When I approach writing, I approach it like I approach an oil painting. So what does that mean? So let's explain that. So I dedicate a considerable amount of time preparing, when I oil paint, I dedicate a considerable amount of time preparing the palette. I mix the paints. I put into the, medium, the cup, a little bit of linseed oil. I prepare the palette. And that takes time. There is an art form in that as an oil painter. Once you have your palette laid out, then you can get to the canvas. Writing to me right now is the same. I read. I listen to people talk on the subway. I listen to all sorts of music, from alternative rock to 90s rap. And that is my preparing of the palette. And once I get a sense of how other people are writing and how their cadence, what cadence they use with their lyrics, the words they like to use, how they like to rhyme, all of those things. Once I get a sense of that, and once I sort of feel like my palette is set, then I get to writing. Is it perfect? Definitely not. But it's my way, and it's how I do it so far.
Yeah. So I invited, as people from Facebook and Twitter that know you or that just want the opportunity to talk to art directors. I invited them to ask questions, and I'm grateful that you offered to answer them. I should say first and foremost, I don't think we can get to all the questions, but do you mind if I ask a couple that have just come to mind?
So of course.
Whatever you were just saying in that way about the oil painting, what you were saying prior to that about the craft of calling forth these words and the art and balancing that, it made me think of this quote that Jim Hill shared, the Sendak quote. He wrote, I'd love to hear you, Giuseppe, discuss this quote, but to read it, I don't know if you've heard this before. It reads, an illustration is an enlargement, an interpretation of the text, so that the reader will comprehend the words better. As an artist, you are always serving the words. You must never illustrate exactly what is written. You must find a space in the text so that the pictures can do the work. Then you must let the words take over where words do it best. It's a funny kind of juggling act.
Wow. So wait, I'm sorry. Did you just ask me to to dissect and write a thesis or speak a thesis on Murray Sendak?
I think more what I'm asking is, having this quote in mind as we move forward,
sure.
The way you also feel about that relationship between words and illustration and what the artist's role is, being that you do work with artists most of your day.
Right.
And finding how to pull out their best.
Yeah. I mean, goodness.
Also, I'm going to need 18 pages on my desk by Monday morning.
Okay. So, I'll speak to that on a personal level. Hold on. I'm thinking out loud for a second. Okay. So yeah. So look, illustrators, what is illustration? I mean, let's define that for a second. You know, when you are illustrating for a picture book, or a graphic novel or a chapter book or whatever format for kids ages 0 to 14, let's just put it that way. It's just, when we say picture book, I'm just going to, that's shorthand for anything for kids between birth and, preteen. What is your role as an illustrator? You know? And so Sendak is saying you have to sort of find that space. And you know, the text leaves open these pockets, you know, these areas for you as the illustrator to augment the text, to expand on what the author is saying visually, of course, to even provide subtext. One of the things I really like, and I don't mean to say this like, okay, now all of you should do this, because I don't want you all to do this, but one of the things I really like in illustration, especially in picture books, especially because of my father of three children who reads picture books over and over and over again. So you kind of want to see a little bit more, a little bit something else as you read like the 17th version time of it. You want to see a little bit of that subtext, and you also want to see, look, if the text says, this is an apple and your illustration is an apple, well, could that work? Of course it could. But that, to me, is a really fantastic opportunity for you to provide a little bit of subtext, to help the reader, to invite the reader into that experience and nod to them a little bit and say, like, this is an apple, but guess what else is happening? I'll give you a good example. Randolph Caldecott. I can't remember the book title. I wish I could. But there's an illustration I'm thinking of where he is, I hope I'm not wrong here, but there's an illustration that he did. And it's this, you know, it's like a boy, and the boy is playing with a ball or something, and it's in the foreground, and the text is something along the lines of, and please do not quote me on any of this. You can even stop the recording if you want. And it's something along the lines of, like, this is a boy and he's playing with his ball. But in the background, you see, and all of a sudden, and then you see the details. You see that he's really dressed in a sort of high society kind of way, in a Victorian era sort of way, of course. You see then there's a butler in the background. You see that there's a lot of chaos going on. This sort of table, you know, plate is crashing on the ground or whatever. All of a sudden, you get a sense as the reader that, okay, gosh, there's a whole lot more going on here, even though the text is literally just a sentence. So I guess what I'm hoping, I'm touching on some aspect of what Sendak just said there, that illustration is a way to fill in the cracks a little bit. I don't know if filling in the cracks is the right way of saying it, but to provide a visual vessel for the author's words that help move the author's text from their writing desk to the children's bedroom or to the library. That is an illustration. That is an illustrator's job. We, as designers and as illustrators, that is our job. Our job is to help provide a visual interpretation of the text in a way that supports the tone of that text. I mean, that really is the basis for all decisions that we make as art directors. Or at least I'm speaking, I can only speak for myself, but I imagine the other illustrators, art directors would say the same. Mm. What does the text feel like? That is the key. That is always the key, and it always will be the key. Once we know what that
feel like, I like that. What does the text feel like?
Once we understand what that is, then we as art directors will then reach out. We'll go and we'll visit your website's illustrators, and we'll find not just one illustrator, because there's no such thing as a perfect illustrator. There really isn't. There are dozens, handfuls of illustrators that would work for a particular text. Our job is to then present them to the editor to make an argument for you, as an you illustrators out there, to them, to the editor, and say, look, I read the text, and I think that these illustrators would do a great job, and here's why.
But what you're saying in there too, I'm as a writer, I'm hearing that any of that worry at all about what happens to my manuscript after it gets purchased, after it finds its way to an editor, and then you take over, to hear the care that you have, that you are approaching it as the art director, and others like you are approaching it in that way of asking, what does the text feel? What is it calling out? What is it inviting me as an illustrator to add to or to illuminate? Really feels, I mean, I have to say, like a great way to respect my words. And that actually puts me a lot at ease, knowing that, like, oh, cool, an art director really does like what I'm doing and wants to make it pretty. Good, thank
yes.
you.
Yes, I mean, of course we do. I mean, look.
Of course
look,
you do. I know.
I mean, the good ones do. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure in the history of art direction, there have been a few art directors who've warranted the fury of an author in the horrible decisions that they've made on a book jacket or illustration choice. But I think by and large, we art directors want to make you, the authors, happy. This is a true story. Whenever we get authors emailing our editors saying, oh my gosh, I just saw the book jacket. Oh my gosh, I just saw the illustration. This is better than I could even possibly have imagined. I kid you not. That is our goal. That is my goal, at least.
Wow.
When an author comes back to us and says, this is better, or this is what I expected, this is what I wanted, or this is better than what I wanted, I can shut my computer down and we'll go home because my job's done.
Oh, okay. Well, so let's get there. Let's get to that point through these questions. I have okay. questions that lead sort of up to that. Okay. And sure. One of the things that I know you from online, is on Twitter. The hashtag people can follow is Mailers and Coffee, that mm-hmm. once a week you show, I assume it's a selection of postcards, or is it every single postcard you get that week?
That's a great question. It's every single postcard I get that week.
Okay.
It's not a selection. I think some people think it's just a selection, and I hope they don't.
I don't know if I'm anticipating that sometimes you must get billions in or sometimes you don't. I guess, though, if I'm taking pictures of, look at the books I got this week, sometimes I get a hefty stack and other times mm-hmm. It's a handful. So that makes sense. And I love that you often are tagging the artists where you can on there. That says to me, not only did you receive it, but you're taking that effort of recognizing, oh, cool, you have a social media presence. Let's let you know that it arrived.
Right. Well, can I just say one thing?
Please.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Say
on
many
that.
More things. Go ahead.
Here's why we do that. So my design assistant, Julia, who's fantastic. She and I every Wednesday look at my mailers, my postcard mailers, and most of them are postcards. Some of them are, you know, sometimes catalogs from agents and or calendars, things like that. Here's why we do that. First of all, we look at them because we have to look at them. That's my job. My job is to look at the postcards that you send. So send them because they work. And I'm not the only person who says that. But the second thing I want to, the second sort of reason we do that is that I want to just remind illustrators that I know what it feels like to send postcards out. Believe me, I've done it myself. It feels literally like you were throwing money into a black hole. You know, it does. You spend however many hundreds of dollars or whatever on a handful, you know, hundreds of postcards, you send them all out and you don't get anything back. And that feeling is terrible.
Yeah.
You know, it's no one's listening to you. It makes you feel isolated. Trust me, I understand that feeling. So the thing with mailers and coffee is that we just want to let you know that we got your postcard. We got it. It works. And we're looking at it, and we're enjoying a really lovely Wednesday morning, drinking coffee and looking at your art, and that's sort of a special thing.
The qualities of what makes it a keeper for you, I talked a little bit before recording about how fast sometimes I can get I can connect with a picture book, right. That there are times when. From the moment I open the first page, I feel compelled to read it more. And there are other times when I read the book a couple times, and that's when it hits it for me that I'm like, oh yeah, this is sticking with me more than I realized. What kind of qualities make that postcard a keeper for you? This is, I should say, Laurie Richmond was asking in particular, what makes a postcard a keeper for you? And also, she would like to know your favorite gelato flavor, obviously.
Why? Because I'm Italian? Come on.
It says OBVS, so she feels comfortable enough to move you.
Obs. Come on, Matthew. Obs. I'll answer the harder one first, and that's the gelato flavor. It's pistachio.
Oh, tricky. Yeah, classic.
I like pistachio. Yeah. I don't know why.
So good. I like then figuring out your gelato flavor is harder than what makes it a keeper.
Oh, yeah.
Tells me, well, there's like a voice inside that's telling you.
Oh yeah. I mean, the gelato thing is difficult because I'm a big Nutella. I'm a Nutella. I'm a recovering Nutella addict. Oh my goodness.
Oh,
I used to just abuse our Nutella jars on a nightly basis. I haven't done so in a long time, and yet I still every now and then think of Nutella. I literally just think of Nutella. there's a Nutella gelato flavor. There's that. I'm a big fan of coconut anything. So coconut gelato is also there, but pistachio is just a classic flavor. Anyway, sorry to get off the rails here. What makes a postcard a keeper? That is really that's a great question. First of all, thank you, Lori.
Obs.
the real answer is, and this is not an answer I know you're going to want to hear, but it's, I keep postcards because it checks two boxes for me. It shows me that you are an illustrator who, no, this is an answer you want to hear. Why would I say that? Of course, this is an answer you would want to hear. It checks two boxes for me. One is a good postcard will show me who you are as an artist. It will exhibit the kinds of decision making that I look for when I look for illustrators. So, you know, what does that mean? It shows me that you understand things like value range, color theory, composition. It's funny because it's a 5x7 rectangle. So it's a whole lot of, you're packing in a whole lot in there, but you see it. You know, if you do this as long as I've done it, 18 years, it doesn't take too long. So you see those things. I see that you are someone who knows how to do what you do. And I also see that you are someone who has a way of interpreting the world. And it's interesting to me. So there's that. I can see that there's someone there who has a few marbles rolling around upstairs. The second thing I see is there's someone here who has that technical ability to do whatever it is that they're doing. And I don't really, frankly, I don't care. And I've say this to my students every time I talk to them. I don't care what medium you use. I don't, it doesn't matter. Not to me anyway. It can be Photoshop brushes. It can be traditional media. It could be watercolor. It can be gouache. It could be popsicle sticks for all I care. As long as it's really well done and as long as it's interesting in some way, it's going to catch my attention. And if all of those things are sort of, there's that sort of confluence of factors, I'm going to keep your postcard. I'm going to look at it. And if you are on social media, I will tag you to let you know that I got your postcard, and I will save it, or I'll show it to one of my designers who's looking for an illustrator. And it just so happens that the text that goes back to the text that they are working on their book, the tone of this illustration, this postcard matches up with that text. I will hand them that postcard, and you never know. And we may give you a phone call. So that's how I keep postcards. But throw away about 95% of the rest.
Okay. I was gonna say, what does keeping postcards look like for you? Like, do you file them somewhere, I assume, or do you hang them all up, or how long do you hold on to them? Yeah. What does that look like for you?
I hold on to them fairly indefinitely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I grew up in a household where my mother would mop and polish everything every single day. We had rooms that were formal rooms that we weren't as kids allowed to even go in. There was plastic on the couches. I mean, it was the whole thing, the whole Italian thing, you know? Don't touch anything. I know this is your house and you live here, but you can't touch anything. That's how I lived. So I have a little bit of that OCD action happening. So my postcards are organized in a little bit of hanging files sort of way. That's how I do it. Other art directors put it on their boards, on their walls. So, you know, it's decorative, but it's also there. So they see it a handful of ways. But my way is really, I look at your postcard. I go and I look at your website. If I still like what I see, I'll bookmark it, you know, digitally. I'll bookmark your website. And then I will also follow you on Twitter.
So extending from that, Scott Soder asked he said websites and postcards aside, what's another effective way for illustrators to market to art directors? But I'm wondering, just even on a larger scale, how else do you find those artists to work with aside from your postcards or visiting these websites? Are there other means?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Hey, Scott, that's a good question. Thank you. This is a topic we've talked. I mean, this is something that we talk about. We being illustrators, me and you, illustrator out there. This is something we talk about on Twitter all the time. You know, what are the traditional ways and what are the non-traditional ways? I'm feeling like social media is now just becoming a traditional way. I think we can say that.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
It just is. For me, Twitter is the first door I open when I look for illustrators. It definitely is. I have an associate art director who swears by Instagram. You know, and I know other art directors also go by Instagram, other goes by Twitter, others, you know, it really all depends. But social media, even if you're not a social media person, and you really don't have to be, a guru or not a guru, but you don't have to be a master at the craft. But once you get into it, man, once you really want to be a writer or an illustrator, I think social media is just an inevitable tool you have to use. So Twitter for me. The second thing is postcards. I usually, I get, you know, 10 to 20 postcards a week. I look at those, email blasts, those are the traditional ways. The non-traditional ways, it's harder to explain. I mean, I'll give you one example and let me see if I can think of a second. And you could probably give some examples here too, Matthew. Mm-hmm. One is there's an illustrator who, can still to this day does an illustration a day. She gives herself these little mini assignments, and she does these little cute spot illustrations of animals. And she does one a day. She forces herself to do one illustration every single day. And that effort, and she tweets them every single day, and that effort sort of made its way into my timeline. I looked at them, and then all of a sudden, again, it was sort of a combination of factors where her work was great. I it spoke to me in some ways, you know, in many ways. I liked it, you know. I mean, that's the simplest way to say it. Her work was really good. It was art that I would want to work, you know, someone who I would want to work with.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that we were working on a book, or a project rather, that needed someone of that sensibility. And one thing led to another really quickly. I saw her work on Twitter. I really liked it. It worked with the project that we had that we needed an illustrator, for which we needed an illustrator. Boom, we hired her.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's how that's. Yeah, go ahead.
Mine is in that way of, so like at All the Wonders, we reach out to illustrators to ask if they'd be interested in doing some spot illustrations here and there, if they're ever, and then we promote them a lot, and then hopefully, you know, you're on our site and maybe someone will see you on our site. But right. One fun way I found a couple of different artists was through Gallery Nucleus.
Yes.
I fell in love with, well, we talked about Zelda on here already. I fell in love with this cute Fox Link illustration that was by this person named Tegan White. And I didn't know who Tegan White was. And it turns out since then that Tegan White's published a couple Barefoot Critters books that I love.
Yeah.
And to think that like I found you from a gallery show was my entrance to you. Was something that to me, that was Chris Apple Hans. Is this Apple?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Apple Hans. Yeah.
Same thing, that I saw that and then went, wait, I know this guy, and realized that he had illustrated that wonderful Sloth book. And then I've now been watching for him to create more things because of knowing so much more of his aesthetic through, for example, Gallery Nucleus or something like that. And then I just sort of lurk on Kidlit Art because I'm a person that likes looking at art, but that's not much different from you. You like looking at art and you want to find new, cool, beautiful, talented people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, it's, but yeah, there's, Gallery Nucleus is definitely one way of finding illustrators. There are online artist collectives. There's a whole lot of ways. Here's the point. The point is, as an illustrator, and here's what's so challenging about being an illustrator. First of all, you have to raise a family or you have to pay the bills. So you start there, and already life is hard. So you start there, your car breaks down, you got to pay, you know what I mean? Like it's difficult. So you get there and then now you have to work and you have to draw and illustrate. You have to draw and paint. Drawing and painting isn't easy, you know, and it's a challenge. So you draw and paint, then you have to market yourself. So you have to make it, show it and sell it. So first you have to make it, and that's already hard enough. Then you got to show it. And by showing it, you know, you use the sort of the methods that you use. You have a social media presence. You put forth your work in whichever way you feel most comfortable, whether that's with Instagram or Twitter. You do your Kidlit Art hashtag, or you do Inktober or whatever. I'm a big fan of Inktober, by the way.
Oh, no doubt.
Oh, yeah.
I had Jake Parker on here, and we, after interviewing him because of this picture book, The Sparrow, Bot and Sparrow, I decided that we were going to try Inktober in my school. And so I made this giant bulletin board, and my kids drew on post-it notes, and we just stuck them to the different – he had created – these prompts for Inktober, just for people that wanted to follow them. And so my students, we just made this giant interactive bulletin board where they all just drew along. And for them to be able to, now for me to tell illustrators right now listening, that it meant so much that my students, meant to them that they got to draw alongside all of you making these illustrations.
Yeah.
That was huge to them to even be included in a platform. Now it's Twitter. They don't quite understand that full way, but to know that their art was included alongside these other people that they just thought were so incredible was something that was really special to them. So being part of that community, I think, goes a long way.
Sure. I mean, they feel like they're part of something.
Exactly.
I'm going to touch on that for a second, but I want to just finish that answer. You know, so you do your social media thing in however you feel most comfortable. And then you do your postcard thing, and that's however many months you know, whatever you can afford. If you want to send postcards every 3 months, go for it. You want to do your email blasts. It's a whole lot like phishing. I mean, I consider myself to be a fisherman at all. In fact, I don't really particularly care for it. I enjoy the idea of it. It's like anything. It's like kind of going to Disneyland. It sounds great. But then when you do it, it's probably all really not as good as you think it was, as you think it will be. But phishing is a lot like that. You know, marketing is just, you know, and of course it is. This is nothing novel. You know, when you hear people like, it hooked you, or it has the right hook. I mean, that's, where do you think these words are coming from? So in phishing, you go out to a pond where you feel like you can catch the fish, illustrators and even writers, I guess. And you put on the bait that you really feel like the fish would like, and then you cast out your line. And if you don't catch anything, you reel it in and you cast it out, and you reel it in, cast it out. You keep doing that over and over again. You sort of keep sending out that signal that you are there and you have this hook, and fish, hey, come on in. And if it works, then great. If it doesn't, then you may need to move to a different part of the lake, or wherever the metaphor is. I don't even know where we are now, lake or pond. You know what I mean? You have to move to a different part of that area and try again, and maybe try a different bait, no doubt. You know, try a different bait. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah. You know, we get a lot of the questions also revolved around the style of illustration, the illustration mm-hmm. style. Tarsila Cruz asked about what's more important when you're hiring an illustrator, their consistency or high quality technical skills or fresh ideas. There was another one that was Debbie Calderon asked, how do you balance focusing your portfolio to your niche without pigeonholing yourself to just that area? Mm-hmm. Are you able to speak at all to that voice that you see illustrators demonstrating, and also then as an art director, how you work with what you perceive in that voice on the postcard and then later on in their website?
Style is the most damaging concept in illustration.
The most damaging.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you why. Let me just frame my thought here for a second. So when I was in art school, in undergrad, we had teachers who said, you know, you got to find your style. You have to, you know, find your style. You have to, what is your style? What is that one thing that you're known for? And you got to be that, telling a bunch of 19-year-olds to find their style. And what happened to me anyway is that I was so concerned about finding my style, and so concerned about what that meant. Like, how did it compare to what was going on out in the world at the time? I was a big Jordan Issop fan in sort of the editorial world. I was a big Dave McKeon fan, Steven Kroniger, those folks. And I felt like, oh, well, excuse me, my style is something along those lines. I like those guys, and their work speaks to me in some way. So let me see if I can go that route. And I spent years trying to chase the idea of style, that it was something you could, that was there, out there in the world somewhere, and that your job as an illustrator was to go find it. And I felt that was what style was for years. It took me more than 10 years to really finally snap out of that vortex of style and really think. I'm going to assume this is a G-rated podcast, so I won't say, but to say forget it. I'm going to just do what speaks to me. I'm going to fall back in love with what I loved, what I liked about painting and drawing before I had to look for my style. And guess what happened?
You found it.
Exactly.
That trust in yourself, it's so hard to turn off the other noise. But there's something to be said for the ostrich with its head in the ground, because of the way that you can not let those other influencers prevent you from moving forward. You have to be able to move forward with yourself first. Sure. Trust yourself.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's at the risk of sounding incredibly nerdy here, I'm going to quote someone in a second, but so there's, as you know, and I'm
so
not
excited.
Saying,
I'm like on the edge of my seat. Which Star Wars quote will he choose? No, go ahead.
Boom. You nailed it. Of course you nailed it. So, look, as an illustrator, of course you're going to see these other illustrators. You're going to see these influences. You're going to, of course, I mean, you just can't help it. You go to Instagram and you see the great illustrations that everyone else is doing. Guess what you don't see? You don't see the crumpled up pieces of paper on the floor. You know, you don't see the mistakes. Everyone puts up on social media the perfect thing, and then that's what you feel like everyone else is doing when it really isn't the case. So you see these other illustrators, and you know this more better than most. You review so many books, you read so many books. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing how everyone else is writing. You see how they sort of lay down their wording and sort of figure out how they would set the tempo of how they write. And, you know, and you can't help but to be influenced by it. You can't help but to be challenged by it. And so anyway, there are all of these external factors, right? Other people are doing it better than I am. Look at this, look at these influences. I want to paint like so-and-so, all of these things. And all of that does is it just sort of filibusters that experience that you need to have as a writer or an illustrator to have that genuine, unencumbered experience of discovery on a page, whether that's in a sort of textual way or visual way. So here's the quote. The quote is, as Obi-Wan once said in A New Hope, you have to let go of your conscious self and reach out with your feelings. And that to me is what is a key. I don't know if it's the key, but it's definitely a key to finding your style.
Yes. So, okay. You've found someone who is demonstrating their style, who's trusting in themselves and in that amazing, miraculous way, the art that they've shown you is the right fit for the project that you want to work on. This is where I want to go now. So Mike Ciccatello writes, you've reached out to a new illustrator. This is a first-time illustrator for something being published, decided to engage in a project. It's their first book project in children's literature. So Giuseppe, what does this relationship look like between you and that illustrator? I know that it'll be different on a case-by-case basis, but broad strokes, what does it look like when you work with someone for the first time?
That's a good question. The short answer is it doesn't look all that different than working with someone who's a veteran. In fact, I've had experiences in which I've worked with veteran illustrators and had more problems with them than I did with the person who's taking their first steps into children's books. So it's about the same.
So what is the what does that back and forth look like? This is me being nerdy asking. So
yeah, no,
so you've hired someone to. Well, let's go with to do a cover on a middle grade. This mm-hmm. is the person you want to do. Do you like give them the manuscript and say, okay, in 3 months I want to see a couple samples? Are they mm-hmm. working with you along the way? I know you're dealing with a lot of books being published every month, let alone every year. So on an individual basis with that person, what does that look like?
You said it. It definitely varies. It's a case-by-case thing. But generally, it's mostly a conversation.
Okay.
And a conversation based on trust. that the editor trusts me to, well, first the editor provides me the manuscripts and they trust me to make good decisions in terms of finding the illustrator. We find the illustrator, and then the trust is placed on that illustrator to, again, produce a visual interpretation of that text. To create, particularly specifically, you were mentioning middle grade. So let's unpack that for half a second. You know, what is their job? What is this illustrator's job? To create an illustration that is essentially an advertisement for the book, and to reach into that story, reach into the author's text, and pull out the details that they feel are important to show on a cover. And I'm sort of along. They take me along for the ride. I tend to want to trust the illustrator and not get too involved. I can't help but sometimes doodle an idea for a cover, even though I really do try to keep that down to a minimum. I don't want to be like, look at me, I can illustrate too.
no, draw it this way.
Yeah, exactly. No. But you know, the illustrators that I hire, I trust them. They're just incredibly talented. They make my job really sort of a privilege. I don't even know where to begin. But so I hire these illustrators, and they create that work that pulls something out of the text that I maybe don't even see. When done well, that art, and coupled with my design or the design of my designers, it makes that package, right? And it makes the package, it goes back to, you know, what is it that we do? We create this visual vessel that takes your text, you know, you as the author, Matthew, your text into the world and onto a shelf at a library or a bookstore. It is then at that point an advertisement. It's really what it is. I mean, yeah. We sell this book. So you do judge a book by its cover. There's no doubt.
It's the reason. I mean, forget bookstores. It's the reason why children take a book off a shelf or not in the library. If I choose that book to be facing out, because they can't all face out, that will be the determining factor on whether or not a kid picks it up.
Right. Yeah. And so they pick it up. So it's advertisement, then they pick it up. So the advertisement part has been completed. They pick it up and they like it. So now there's a connection. So this design, this marriage of design and illustration is now morphing into something else. First it was an ad, and now it's something else. Now it's an experience. It's a companion. As the child, as the reader reads that book, the jacket or even the illustrations, even if it's a picture book or anything, helps that reader move through the story, mm-hmm. and have that experience with as little friction as possible. When done well, when children's book illustration and design is done well, there is zero friction for the reader as they move through the story of the author. So now it becomes a companion. Now it goes along for the ride.
Yeah.
It helps the reader understand the author's text. Once the book is done, that part of the job of the illustration and the design morphs into something else. It morphs into a third, the third version of itself. I don't know, where it then becomes sort of a token. It becomes this thing where it's a reminder of that experience. Yeah. It's kind of
nice. I like that.
You know what I mean? It's like a souvenir.
It is. You know? I have a book that, as soon as you started talking about this, a middle grade book came to mind, and you're just affirming like one thing after another that book, the identity of that book, and I would argue the identity of me as a reader of that book is 100% because of the cover.
I as a designer, I'm like, yeah, exactly. But sure. Yeah. I mean, it just is. And that's it. And that's what it is. So to go way back to that question, you know, first time illustrators, it's really a matter of trust. And I've had experiences in which I'm currently working with first time illustrators. On a personal level, I find it as a point of pride to bring in completely new voices, visual new voices into the children's book world. It's really kind of exciting, frankly. And it's exciting when I work with veterans. I've worked with, you know, folks who've been in the industry for a long time. And so there's a whole lot of, there's a different set of challenges and a different set of happy experiences with vets, compared to amateurs, not amateurs, but, you know, newcomers. But it's different. I guess the short answer is too late. Yeah. The short answer is that it's just different.
But, you know, I hear that trust, and it I can't help but think that the trust has to go the other way too, to the illustrator, likewise to the author, trusting that, more for the illustrator in this case, because you work with them in that way. But me as an author working with an editor, trust yourself to be able to rise to the occasion and give something good. Trust yourself to be able to create and go somewhere with it and then bring it to you or bring it to the editor, mm-hmm. and say, this is where I think, I feel moved to lead it. Help me to edit it, as it were, right. to make yeah. it what it needs to be. Hey, so Anna Toten asked a question that I've been really curious about forever too, which is, how do you decide if a middle grade will be illustrated, and like to what degree, how many illustrations would go in? She references chapter headers versus mm-hmm. full page and spot mm-hmm. illustrations. I know that chapter books, I mean, reading chapter books, I know that there's sort of it feels there's an unspoken rule that every other page or every couple pages, I'll get an illustration on there, sort of keeping the reader engaged with illustration, right. that balance. But, mm-hmm. but there are also wonderful middle grade novels that do have more concentrated illustrations and mm-hmm. others that don't. So are you on the end of making that decision?
I like to think that I am, I mean, but probably not. I go into work thinking that I am. I leave work knowing that I'm not. No, I, you know, that's a conversation. Again, it goes back to everything that we talk about tonight, and everything I think in life is all about communication. Clearly, it's all about having that honest conversation with whomever. And so, in this case, to answer Anna, hi Anna, to answer your question, it's just about, you know, usually the author has an idea or two, but it usually starts with the editor. At least it does for us. You know, the editor will say, hey, here's this thing, and we would like there to be a chapter, an illustration on every chapter header, you know, just the chapter headers. Or like in the past, we've done like sort of middle grade, like we did Dark Crystal prequels and they were middle grade, and we worked with Corey Godby, and we were like, okay, we know we want to do these full page illustrations that are sort of interspersed throughout the text, and there isn't any sort of like set tempo to it. It isn't just like every chapter opener. It's just every now and then we're going to throw in these illustrations. Mm-hmm. It's really about tempo. I mean, I don't pretend to be a music theorist or anything, but I think it has a lot to do with that. And also has a lot to do with what the reading level is, and, you know, middle grade, chapter book, YA, all of those. They all kind of, some of them overlap. Some publishers have different definitions of what they are. You know, some they're like, well, middle, you know, chapter books is, you know, 8 to 10, and middle grade is 10 to 12, whatever it is. So it really, again, the short answer is the short answer is always going to be for every single question in life, it depends. But in this case, it's just really a matter of how we want to put forth that text. Do we want it laden with illustration, and do we want it, and not laden, that's not the right word, but do we want it, the illustration, does it need so much? Does it need to be illustration heavy? Or can it carry itself with some illustrations? It really kind of depends on how we want to position it, to the world.
So Julia Wasson asked this question, and Maple Lamb kind of asked a question hitting both sides. So I'm going to ask you a question regarding authors and illustrators' growth and work. But part of this is personal for me as an author too, knowing that I've had work out on submission, and I'm blessed to be working in a critique group of illustrators because they can help me understand how much room I'm leaving for the illustrator and mm-hmm. Where is it appropriate to leave art notes or not. I tend to be a person that doesn't like to leave them because I get too in my head about, like, I don't want to tell the illustrator what to do, but I'm also aware that there are emotional arcs that I'm trying to convey that I leave out of the text, but that could be something that could be worked in. I don't know. Anyway, Julia, I should just read hers. Julia Wasson wrote, "What do you wish authors knew about writing texts that'll be illustrated by very probably artists that they don't know?" And on the other side of it, Maple Lamb asks, "From your professional observation over time, what are some common weaknesses among artists that you wish to see them work and improve upon?" So I'm looking at both sides. Words of wisdom to give to authors about the room to leave for artists, and likewise with those artists, what are things to focus on to be able to not take up that room that we leave, but you know, to bring their best. I clearly need to just stop talking. I know you know what I'm talking about. I'm now over-explaining myself.
No, you're not. You're actually you're about 65% into answering that question already. I'm like, keep talking and you'll answer the question. Going back to some of the stuff that we've been talking about, you know, leaving room is a really great way of thinking about it. So as an author, when you think about the illustrations, you know, and again, it goes back to communication. So I've had this question before posed to me, you know, what do I do as an author? What do I write in the art notes? Do they have to be incredibly explanatory, or can they be really sort of loosey-goosey and vague? And really, I mean, here's the answer. The real answer is write whatever the heck you want to write. If you want to write 17 paragraphs of art notes, go for it. Just know that they're probably going to get deleted or edited down before they even make it to the artist. Just know that. So that's the answer. The answer is write whatever the heck you want to write. But to answer your question, I personally like it when I think it works. And again, there are caveats and exceptions. But when it works is when the author leaves room for the artist to have that experience of discovery, you know, when you say, okay, look, the art note is going to be, I want this person here and that person there and this prop and this color. And like, when you really get into, when you make it so it's basically VCR instructions, VCR, look at us old people, VCR, you know, it's VCR instructions, then you're robbing the illustrator from having any kind of connective experience.
Right. There's a level of relinquishing control.
Right.
But
and it goes back to trust, of course.
Right? But also, yeah, knowing when there is something that you need to share, trusting also that, well, I can share these notes and they can just delete them. It's okay. If there is something that you want to make sure is being conveyed, that's important to the story or that's important to the feel of the story, then share it, of course.
Just share it. Exactly. I mean, you know, there's this weird feeling, and there's a lot of misinformation and misconception. And
oh yeah. I know where you're going with this. I've had this feeling.
Yeah. About this whole thing. If you want to convey something, if you want to share a thought, share it. No one's going to get in trouble and you're not going to get a wrist slap.
Right. You're not going to get, your manuscript won't get rejected
because of
the grounds of an art note. Exactly.
Of course not. Of course it won't. I just feel like there seems to be, I don't know how overwhelming this is, but it feels constant where people think that there's this, how am I saying this? There's nothing esoteric about getting published. There just isn't. There's no panacea. There's no formula. Hardly any of us really, truly, if we're being honest with ourselves, know what the hell we're doing.
Can I get a witness?
We have guesses, we have ideas, we have thoughts, but when it comes down to it, none of us truly, really know. And maybe I can only speak for myself. I will only speak for myself. I really don't know. When I pick an illustrator, if it's going to work out, I have ideas and I feel fairly confident in the idea of, you know, of the fact, but one never knows. And I feel like a lot of times what we, what we profess to know as fact is never really. But I'm kind of going on a tangent here.
No, you're making me think of The Princess Bride with him saying, I do not think that that word means what you think it means.
Of course. Oh, goodness. Yeah, no, it's, look, what do I want to say here? As long as you are communicative, and as long as you have good ideas, both as writers and illustrators, you know, as long as you have good ideas, as long as what you say and what you write and what you think and what you illustrate touches on something on a personal level for you, that's where you want to go. That is the goal. That's your short-term goal. Write what you want to read, draw what you want to see.
Yes.
Then if it's good, and you know, everyone, and it was like, well, what does that mean? You know what that means. You know,
draw
what it means.
So the weaknesses that we need to work on is draw what you want to see. Trust yourself. It comes back to trust
yourself.
Yeah.
And it totally goes back to what we were saying earlier. Like there's a level of risk aversion, that's happening. It's so funny. And again, I'm kind of going on a tangent, but I'm answering this question, I promise. Is there even a question now? I don't even remember. we are so willing, and this is something, again, this is a relatively recent thought process for me, but we, as I speak to illustrators through the school, we as illustrators, and I would suspect authors are, if they're listening to this, and I'm sure they are nodding their heads maybe, we are so willing to trust any external factor, both real and imagined. We, you know, from waiting for inspiration, you know, these external factors, you know, so we wait for inspiration instead of writing or instead of drawing. We wait for it before we get to it. We feel the need that for luck, you know, if I'm lucky, I'll get the job. We even rely, and we do that, you know, we rely on prayer. We hope hard enough for something, and we think, okay, if I hope for this, if I pray for this, maybe I'll get it. So there are these sort of non-physical factors that we trust so completely. And the one thing that we are not trusting is ourselves. That's the thing we need to be trusting. And it's hard. I know it's hard. I barely trust that this conversation is even a good one. I don't know. I like to believe it that it is. It's hard. It's going to be hard, and no one ever said it's easy. And if someone did say it's easy, then they're wrong. Know that it's hard. It's hard for me. It's hard for you. Not you, Matthew. I'm sure it's easy for you. But it's hard for any, I would imagine that it would be hard for anyone, both award-winning and right fresh out of college. The key is going to always be, what do you, you know, I hear this question. You're like, what do you want to see? Here's what I want to see. I want to see you be truthful to yourself and trust yourself and enjoy the work that you are doing. That's what I want to see.
Man, we could end right there, but I want to wrap up with one question that goes back to you personally and how you manage everything in your own life, Giuseppe. And I will say, Claire Lorden, who is a RISD graduate likewise, asked about what personal art and work you've been doing. And I know you mentioned about the two picture book manuscripts you have out with Alex. But tying that in, another Bookmark Literary wrote, if I could ask you how you make time to create while juggling the full-time job and family. So just, I've talked about that with people too, that balance that I strike up. How have you found a balance that works for you? Or what is the balance you found that works for you personally? Knowing that this is your personal thing and it will be different for everybody else. Am I emphasizing that hard enough? I keep feeling like, you know, you're all different from everyone else.
No, that's oh, okay. My gosh, are you kidding me? That bears repeating over and over. First of all, who said that I have even remotely balanced a full-time job and family.
I believe you literally just said that you seem to think I have it together. So let's be careful here.
That's my impression. That is my impression of you. Goodness. You know,
fake it till you make it, buddy.
Exactly. My parents are immigrants. We've talked about that. And when they were in Italy, they were farmers and they had fifth grade educations. They came over here when they were 16 with nothing. I was raised in a family in which you understood what work you had to do and you did it. And did I learn that lesson? Definitely not. I am a procrastinator of the highest order. Oh my goodness, we could talk about all the ways that I procrastinate and all the really silly ways I procrastinate. It would be amazing.
And five of those ways involve Nutella.
Oh, yes, they do. They involve watching Legend of Korra and eating Nutella sandwiches.
Yes, nice.
No question.
Good call. Nice.
No question. But I do at least know what that looks like, to just know what you have to do when you just have to do it. Now, I'm not saying that people who aren't doing that are lazy. I'm not saying that at all. It's hard. It's incredibly hard. It is. Here's what procrastination, and it goes, I'm going to answer your question. I will. I promise. Teresa and Claire. Procrastination is us just lying to ourselves. We procrastinate. We think that, okay, look, I'll start my work in an hour and I promise it'll be good. And in an hour I'm going to get there and all the worries and all of these deep concerns that I'm really not that good at what I'm doing. I'm just going to avoid those feelings and hope that they go away. And I'm just going to sit here and not do the thing that I really actually have to be doing. And that is truly discovering myself and understanding who I am and where I am in terms of my abilities and my ideas. So we procrastinate. And believe me, I am a better procrastinator than most. I'm procrastinating even answering this question. So, you know, how do you juggle it? You know, here's what I do. I go to work and I come home in time to say goodnight to my three children and hang out with my wife for a little while. And then the procrastination bug sets in. And then I decide, instead of working at 9 or 10 o'clock for a few hours on my personal work, I sit there and watch TV for a little while. And I don't have to do that, but I do. Once I get to the point where I'm like, okay, I really need to be painting, it's midnight. So I'm not very good at it, Teresa or Clara. I'm trying, but the answer to the question is, how badly do you want this thing? You know, and I'm not you specifically, folks, but just you two. But you know, how badly, illustrators and writers, do you really want what you want? Do you really want to be a children's book writer or an illustrator? If the answer is yes, truthfully, then you just do the work. That is really the key. Don't worry about what's going on online. Don't worry about, there's a lot of distractions these days, of course. But when it comes down to it, you find the pockets, even if it's for 20 minutes. And even if you're staring at a blank screen for 20 minutes, at least you gave yourself that chance to be creative. And you do that enough, and next thing you know, you will look backward and see that that time has accumulated to the answer to your question of how you juggle multiple responsibilities.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow.
All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Anna Kang and Christopher Wayant share I Am Not Scared, their newest picture book together. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.